Morning, I'd like to ask that you open your Bibles, please, to the book of Genesis, Genesis chapter 10. We've got a set of notes coming out that we're going to be looking at. It's got the genealogical chart of Japheth on it. I know it sounds like an exciting thing, but we are going to do it. I am who I am, you are who you are, and we are going to do this. So, Genesis chapter 10, and looking at the descendants of Japheth and some of the things that it applies to throughout our lives and throughout history, where it began, where it's going to end. There's some things we're going to be able to learn from this. In Genesis chapter 10, we've got the it says right here, we began this and kind of reviewed chapter 10, 11 last week. But it says, this is the account of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's sons, who themselves had sons after the flood. The sons of Japheth are, and they're listed right there, the names of them, be seven of them mentioned. There's going to be seven sons mentioned and seven grandsons mentioned. And it's going to give us a little bit of a description throughout the scriptures of where they went and what they did, a little bit about that. But even ancient writings tell us where these people went and how they got to the places they were. But you can see them right there on your notes or in chapter 10, verse 2. Gomer, Magog, Media, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tyrus are the seven sons. And of those seven sons, Gomer and Javan then are listed with some other sons that come after them, and some details are given. Now, first of all, we'll come back in just a minute. You may want to keep your place there. I'm going to go to Acts. We went to this last week and looked at this. But Acts chapter 17, and just kind of an insight into this, of what is going on and how this pertains to the different people groups, or some would call them races of people, that we have races scattered around the earth, different races of people. There may be three basic races, or there's all kinds of divisions you can break it down into. But the race is basically talking about the different character traits, physical character traits that people have. Sometimes the word race or races of people tends to have an evolutionary context to it. And most evolutionists or scientists or however people go with this have come to the conclusion that no matter what the race of a person is, they all come from the same people group. They're all of the same genetics. There is an idea, there's many ideas that have come down through the ages, but the idea that some races or people groups are more advanced evolution on the evolutionary scale than others, of course, that leads to racism. But basically, scientifically, the races are equal in all of their makeup. There are some distinguishing differences about the way they appear, and there's differences in culture, but that can be explained even as science looks at or anthropologists study it. It lines right up with the scriptures. Now, this is an interesting topic here, because when we get into this, we start talking science and scriptures we have before in different cases. There's a collision path. It's on a path to a collision. We always say this, and we believe this, I believe this, that the world, if you want to call it science, nature, history, the natural creation, always agrees with the Creator and who He is and what He's done, or in our case, the Creator's revelation of Scripture. So it's safe to say, I believe, that nature or history, the way things are in our natural world, lines up perfectly with the revealed Scriptures that we have right here. The problem comes is that we as Christians are reading the revelation of God, trying to draw out of it the meaning, and we are in a fallen state. We're trying to perceive things that in many cases are beyond our understanding as far as natural ability, and we're trying to draw out of these things the truth. This is the truth. The Word of God is the truth. Our problem comes as we begin to look at that and dissect it, and as Paul tells Timothy, rightly dividing the Word of truth. Now, that we don't have to go too far to understand what I'm saying there. As soon as you go across the road or to another town or to a different denomination, or just look to a different row of pews or a different row of chairs, or look to someone else in your family, you're going to find difference in opinion on the way we divide the word of truth. This remains eternal. We may have errors in the way we understand it. The same then is true with science. Nature is the same. Nature is true, but you got scientists that have different opinions as they go through it. And then we draw out of that the scientists that are looking at nature. You draw out of the scriptures, those that are reading scriptures, and you get scientists and theologians, and now you may have some problems. So as we go through this, and the reason I say that is we spend a lot of time, if you've been watching the blog at all in Generation Word this week, if anybody watching the blog at all, anybody watching? Oh, my wife, very good. Thank you, man. Happy Mother's Day. And to all of you others that didn't read the blog, happy Mother's Day anyhow. But we have an interesting thing going on because we went to the movie Expelled. Anybody heard of the movie Expelled? Okay, you may want to check that out. At least go make a donation. Expelled, it's called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And it's basically about that the theme of the movie, if you agree with it or not, the theme is that the academic world has embraced evolution, has made their final decision. Evolution is true. There is no God. And so stop asking questions. We're moving on. But yet people on the trail side here, including some scientists, academic world saying, wait a minute, the further we get into science, the further we get into DNA and looking into the cell, there's some intelligent design going on here. Now understand, they say intelligent design, they're not saying Jesus Christ, they're saying intelligent design. We don't know who it is, we just know something has happened in our world that this didn't just happen, it's impossible. Consider intelligent design, and it is a walled-off area. You cannot cross over into that academic area, and the movie goes through and interviews several people, professors including at Iowa, who have either been rejected tenure or have been fired or been released from the Smithsonian Institution all the way through different universities, meaning there is a barrier. They do not want questions asked. So I you know, in my innocence, maybe not innocent, but I put a blog up on Sunday night. Hey, we thought it was great. And my point of the blog, one of the points of the blog was one of the great writers, very popular right now, Dawkins, who wrote a book called The God Delusion. Anybody heard of The God Delusion? It's a popular book right now. It's anti-God, anti-Christian, but sold millions of copies. The guy's a millionaire now. Thank God. But he basically attacks the concept of God as a delusion and uses historical proof and evidence and makes fun of the God of the Old Testament being, you know, barbaric and being jealous and you know, killing people and all, you know, like this. No sense at all. And so he's on the movie and he's a scientist and he's defending the evolutionary side of the atheistic position. And, you know, Ben Stein, I'm telling you the movie now, right? Okay, here we are, movie review, you know. Church. I always make fun of pastors who do what I'm doing right now, so keep that in mind, okay? And you're all saying amen. But Ben Stein asked me, he says, so you don't see no need for intelligent design. Anyone who believes in intelligent design, he says, is an idiot. He says it straight up like that, is an idiot. And Ben Stein then says, well, how do you explain the first life in the first living cell? Where did that come from? I mean, it's easy. Once life on the planet, okay, now we have different things can happen. But where do you get that first bolt of life, that first zap of life, that first breathing living cell? He says, one of the best explanations I have is that life from another planet or another form of the galaxy planted life here. Now, understand what he said. He says, if you believe in intelligent design, you're an idiot. But where I think it came from is life, alien life, aliens planted life. Oh yeah, that's so much more intelligent than Christians, or so much more intelligent than Genesis chapter. It's like, and isn't that in a form of intelligent design itself? But anyway, so I put a little blog up on there, and by gosh, I got some response finally. I mean, finally some hate mail, and had a couple of real good conversations through that, and you know, respectfully, some of the people I spoke with or wrote back and forth to, you know, I really enjoyed getting a dialogue with them. I went to one of their sites and did a little blogging there also, and I don't think it's over, but anyway, take a look at the blogs there, and what you find there is the scientific world, and again, I don't know if these guys are actually scientists, they're pretty smart, but they're, you know, they have their opinions colliding with the Christian world, and a lot of times they're attacking the Christian world. The Christians who are really ignorant. When I say ignorant, I mean that really don't even know the Bible. They just got their little, platform answers and just go with that. But anyway, now we're into another area here that is going to have science and the Bible not really colliding, but you've got people in science that care about this and have got opinions about where the races came from, where people originated from, all the different nations. And then you've got the account of Genesis chapter 10 and 11 here, kind of saying this is what is written in the scriptures. Now, I firmly believe that history and Genesis 10 and 11 are going to flow together. They're going to meet. They're going to match. Just like I believe the prophecy in the scriptures about what's going to take place in the future is going to meet in history. It's going to happen just like it says. The problem sometimes comes in as we're looking back or we're looking forward that we make sure we line up. There's no reason to compromise with science and forsake the scriptures, but at the same time, we've got to stay open-minded. I'm not going to drop anything radical on you here, so don't think that. But we've got to stay open-minded and let the scriptures speak to us and not our ideas. And as we go through history talking about peoples and races, there have been some terrible, terrible teachings coming out of the churches about races. I mean, some classic examples, and I could go on and give probably 10 or 12, but two would be enough, is like you've got the white race and the black race, for example. One of the worst examples of this is that the black race comes not from from man, but from the area of the beast, you know, in Genesis chapter 2. It's like, what is that? Who was teaching that? And the church was teaching, obviously the white church, was teaching that. Also, the idea that Cain, the mark put on Cain, now this is ridiculous, it makes sense. The mark put on Cain was he was made black. So everyone know that he was a murderer. And that's where the black race came from. That's coming out of churches would teach it. But it's like they all die in the flood. Now where does that go today? I mean that we don't even need to even read chapter, you know, 6, 7, and 8 of the book of Genesis for that explanation. Others, we're going to see Ham. We're going to see Ham or Ham and Canaan. They're going to be cursed, and they're going to become the black race. And so now they're marked being accursed people. The problem with that is so many things, but scripturally, the people of Canaan and the people of Ham, if you realize, if you pay attention, they're going to actually begin to prosper and have great possessions, not looking like they're cursed at all, during the life of Abraham and through most of the book of Genesis. In other words, there was a curse involved there, but that curse took place and was probably then, as it was dealt with and faded away. And then they have other issues that they're going to deal with as we go through Genesis. So anyway, there's some very terrible things being taught. One of the things I want to look at here, just real quickly, Genesis, Acts chapter 17, we looked at this last week, verse 26. From one man, he made every nation of men. Bingo, there it is. And that could be Adam, or in our case, we're going to say Noah in our context. From Noah, from one man, some translations write that, from one blood, he made every nation. So in other words, in man's fairly recent history, depending on how you're going to look at evolution, the time of the earth, and all these things, we're talking about a limit of some thousands of years. Within that time, all these races, if you go with the scriptural account, man and the flood and Adam, we're talking about 6,000-7,000 year period, something that all these races came from one man. And everybody's, well, how did that happen? That's ridiculous. That's impossible. And then you're going to insert in there, well, God just zapped them at the Tower of Babel. One day he zaps them and their language gets confused, and on their way leaving, he zaps them and makes them different colors. That's okay. That's fine. He could do that if he wanted to. But you're going to have a hard time presenting that at a scientific conference, you know. Well, how do you explain that? You just can't have God zapping things all the way through history. Eventually, you're going to have science is going to have to take effect. And I think what we have here, very simply, and I got this on page 2, 3 of your notes at the bottom. I'm going to just refer to this right here. Out of one man, all the races came. You've got this thing called DNA. You've got genetics. And if the Tower of Babel account is true, which I believe it is, all the people came from Mount Ararat. They went south down to the Shinar Plain. We're going to talk about this later. Down to the plain of Shinar, and they're all living there, grouped on top of each other, because they've got a world that, if you 1-2, became chaotic, and then in the creation account of the 6 days, God began to organize the chaos. That chaos was released back on the earth for the flood, mankind out, and now that chaos has been receded by God, the waters receded, but now you've got what's taken place. You've got wild animals, you've got a world that is just imagine what Iowa would look like if 2 people lived here, or 8 people lived here, or 24. If Iowa was occupied by 50 people, what would it look like? I tell you, the highways wouldn't look real good after a few winters. I mean, yards would not be getting mowed. I mean, it wouldn't happen. The fields wouldn't. What would happen? chaos would set in, or what we would say, the jungle, or the prairie, or it would be wild animals would just begin to reign and rule. And that is what the world would have looked like within a few years after the flood. Man is populating the earth, but animals are populating, things are growing, nature is taking place, and there is a need for man to set out and begin to make his place in the world, which would take a lot of work. Wouldn't it be easier if we all just lived together on the plain of Shinar? We've got language. Everything is right here. We've got some taking us from the wild animals. Remember, the wild animals are coming. They're growing, multiplying, and they're not going anywhere. And so at that time, it is not difficult. It is not ridiculous. It is very simple to understand. One race or one people. You've got one language. You've got one culture. And everybody's intermarrying with everybody right there. And basically, the color of the people staying the same. The physical characteristics are staying the same because there's an even distribution of the gene pool in that group of people. We're in science now. But God wanted them to fill the earth, which they were not going to do. And they began to build the towers, you know, we're going to become like God, the whole concept there. And God confused their languages, which then began to form the different pockets of people. They began to separate from each other. And now, no matter how you slice or dice it, if the people are separated, if it happened with the languages and the people moved because of the languages or because of some kind of topography change, we'll talk about that when we get there, the people are going to be separated. And once they get separated, they're going to have their own language. That group of people is going to begin to form their own culture, their own laws, their own civilization. And within a few years, it does not take very long. The genetics, we'll use the word inbreeding, but as not in a negative sense. You've got this pocket of people, this group right here, distinct traits are being gathered together right here, and they continue to marry within this certain group. It's going to be easier to marry, as we all know, someone who speaks your language, is of your culture, and you can relate to. Well, that's going to be someone who's in this group of people, and what's going to end up happening is certain genetic traits are going to take over, be dominant. It's going to take place in each of those people's groups. It's no different than we see in our own families. We just look around in your own families, you know, two or three generations. There's a certain genetic type. You know, so your children are going to have certain character traits because of their parents. If it's going to be height, if it's going to be weight, if it's going to be intelligence, if it's going to be whatever it is, certain talents or gifts, they're going to have in this area that they're going to be gifted in or blessed in or genetically given to. It happens. We can see it at family reunions. Everybody looks like, you know, the same general idea. That is what takes place within a few. The DNA. Look at these notes right here. How I wrote this down right here. Let me just read through this. How do the different skin colors originate? First bullet point: we all have the same coloring pigment in our skin called melanin. All skin color is some shade of brown. Most likely, in that area of the Tower of Babel, they would have had some kind of a similar brown color. They wouldn't have all been white, like we would say, like I am. Or they wouldn't all be, you know, a dark or black color. They would have probably been some kind of a, because it would all been neutralized, everybody kind of even. Melanin protects the skin against violet damage from the light of the sun. And you know this, it's we're heading towards summer. And we all have a capacity for melanin in our own DNA. When I go out in the sun, I'm going to get a little tan, but there's a limit to how much melanin I'm going to be able to produce. My wife goes out a lot more. I mean, she spends 10 minutes in the sun, boom. I mean, her skin is changing quickly. So each of us has a different level. Now, too little melanin in a very sunny environment will cause sunburn or skin cancer. If you're spending a lot of time in the sun, the area's got a lot of sun, maybe it's a warm climate. People with white skin are going to be absorbing too much sun rays, and it's going to begin to produce sunburn, which they can't function. It's going to produce skin cancer. They are not going to be able to function. In other words, in that group, this is, okay, are you all right with this? Are you still with me? All right, I mean, we're not really reading a Bible verse here. But that group right there, the laws, something, you know, people talk about Darwinism, you know, and this was, we got into the debate on the blogs a little bit this week. It's like, well, how can you explain this event in human history without using Darwinism? Well, everything Darwin or scientists who are evolutionists teach is not false. Do you understand what I'm saying? Any more than anything, everything a Christian discovers is Christian. And I didn't need to, but I was getting ready to write the blog, because they were saying, you can't use Darwin's information. You can't use the evolution's information. It's like, okay, I won't, but you can't use the Christian's information. You know, Christians like Newton, who discovered gravity, or Galileo, who discovered the rotation of the earth around the sun. You can't, that's a Christian doctrine. That's a Christian. Or Einstein, who believed in intelligent design. He says God doesn't play dice with the universe, so you can't have Darwin. Darwin believed in intelligent design, or believed in some kind of a creator who's controlling things. So, what, they're not going to use Einstein, Galileo, or Newton? Well, they certainly are, because those are scientific principles. And the same thing, evolutionists, they can believe in evolution, they can be atheists, but they can still discover scientific principles. And I think one of the things that they've discovered, which you can't argue with, is survival for the fittest. I mean, if you are sunburned, if you've got skin cancer, if you can't function in a hot, sunny area because your skin doesn't have enough melanin, you are not going to produce. You can't provide for your family, let alone have a family that's going to live. To fade away, and so now the next generation is going to have children with those who are surviving in the area, and they're going to be those with the darker melanin in their skin, and they're going to then obviously produce darker children. In fact, my skin color, my lighter skin color, just with Tony, my children have lost my fine skin color. And they tan a lot nicer than I do. I burn, they tan. She told me when we were got married, she says, you know, brown is dominant. And so the eyes in the womb, we're becoming brown-eyed people. Yeah, I know, Zach, hang on, buddy. Hang on, brother. Zach still got the blue eyes for one more generation. But it's like things happen, and the same thing is around certain areas, different groups of people. The people with more melanin would have survived, produced more food, had healthier children. Listen, not millenniums of years, but within a few generations, that trait is dominant. Now we go north. We go north where you need to have some sun, but at the next point there, too much melanin with little sunshine will make it difficult to get enough vitamin D, which needs sunshine for its production. Result is vitamin D deficiency leads to bone disorders. Further north you go, people are getting colder, wearing more clothes, less sun, days are shorter in the winter. People with light skin, like myself, we thrive in the cold. Why? Why the cold? But they, you know, the more you get into the Scandinavian countries, they would thrive there because their skin can absorb more of the sunlight, which produces the vitamin D, and they remain healthy. Those that have darker skin are not going to do as well in that area. And thus, very simply, the same thing with any kind of character traits. If it be height, if it's not even just survival, if it's just the same inbreeding of the same, if it's short, they just continue to get short. Or tall, the blue eyes, go back to the blue eyes. You can find in the Scandinavian countries the dominant of blue eyes. And as you move through Europe, Central Europe, down to the Mediterranean, you get less blue eyes until finally you go through the Mediterranean world into Africa, and blue eyes are rare. That's just the way it ended up being set up. That was the way it was. Again, I talked to Tony and me. Tony told me, keep it personal. All right, babe. We're both the Moore family and the family. The names are both German. They come from Germany. Of course, I've got French and Crete Indian and our Creek Indian. Different. You know, there's more in our background than just the two names. But nonetheless, she's got, again, a darker skin, darker eyes, the beautiful dark hair. I've got the peaked white skin, you know, eyes. But we had someone visit us from. We haven't been to Germany ever, but we had someone over from Germany coming to school over here. And he says, Wiemers and Moors are still, they're still names in Germany. He says, and what's interesting, he says, and the Wiemers family that I come from came up from the north side of Germany, up on the North Sea up there, where, you know, near the Scandinavian side, almost in the islands. But he says, the Wiemers are in that part of the Germany, but as you go further south in Germany, he says, that's where you find the Moors, M-O-H-R. And he says, the Moors in the southern Germany
darker brown eyes, where the Weimers have the whiter skin, the blue. And it's just amazing. You can see a trend coming from going to the south, but nonetheless, that's the personal side of that. So the point of this right here is what is going to take place here in chapter 10 and 11 is that the people, the unified people, are going to be dispersed. There is no reason to have Noah have three colors of suns. You know, a white sun, a yellow sun, and a brown sun. That doesn't have to happen. Just, it's all there. You just pool the people together, put clusters of people behind mountain ranges. You put them across oceans, and you have them intermarry. They're going to produce a strong genetic trait in that group of people. For example, the Asian eyes are the same eyes that Europeans would have. It's just that there is more fat around the eyes, fatty tissue around the eyes, and so those eyes appear different. No more than I know on the Weimer side, sometimes there's a bigger, longer nose. It's like, you know, it's like, what is that? It's genetic. It doesn't mean it. It's just genetics. That's what is produced. Now, let's go back to Genesis chapter 10. I hope that explains some things about races. God didn't need to zap the people and make them different colors. You don't need to place a curse on the black people to get the black people. It's got to do with what is in their genetics. Now, I'll say this too. Listen to this. It's on those same notes. If you take any two people, their DNA difference between any two people from any race you want to choose them from, their DNA difference is going to be 0.2%. Are you with me? Their DNA difference between any two people, if it's from this congregation right here, or if it's from you and a person in a congregation from the other side of the world, your DNA difference is 0.2%. Of that difference, of that 0.2% difference, okay, now we're going to take a fraction of that fraction. 6% of that 0.2% of the difference is because of your different people's group, because of your different race. So 6%, which is small, of a total 0.2%, which is very small, is because you're from a different race. That 0.2% that is different between any two people is going to be 85% is going to be simply because you're a different person. In other words, two people in this congregation or two people in your family are going to have a 0.2% difference. Of that, 85% of that difference is simply because you're two different people. In other words, you are more different than people sitting in here because you're two different people, way more different from of two different people than you are because you're from a different race. In other words, the races are so close together that it's hardly worth mentioning. That's amazing information. That's amazing information. Now, we go back to Genesis chapter 10. And here we go. Is that, you say, well, that's not important information. My gosh, can you think of anything more important in our world today than that issue? We talk about tolerance. We have tolerance days in school where we talk about tolerance. And, you know, we had a little day to this week. It was a good little thing we did in school this week. We had tolerance week. And we tried to tell the kids that, you know, everybody's got to get along. Everybody's got to work together. Because when you step outside, we're killing each other, bombing each other, destroying each other because of different races and cultures and everything. Now, because during lunch in a middle school that we can, I say it's like spitting in the ocean, but nonetheless, it's something we need to work on. But the idea there, tolerance, is we think we can do something, but it is on the front page of the newspaper. Not, of course, global warming's on the front page of Des Moines Register today. But it is an issue in every culture, wherever you are. Now, here we go. Genesis chapter 10. The sons of Japheth, I've got them listed right here on page 1. I'm going to read through some information very quickly. And then on page 3, you can see at the top a map of where the sons of Japheth settled. Just interesting. Now, if you're a thinking person, you go, wait a minute. Noah had three sons. I only see Japheth here today. Does that mean next week we're going to do another one and in 2 weeks we'll do the other one? It's like, yep. Oh, my gosh. If you ever want to plan a vacation, now's a good time. The map that you see right there, the people of Japheth. Now, remember, Shem, Ham, and Japheth if you're going to stay with basic science, they have the same mom and dad, and so they are going to look as similar as the Cirillo boys or the Weimers boys. Okay? Do you understand?
No, I don't mean you and Ryan look the same, Zach. You're not that lucky. I mean, you look like Zach or Jacob and Nathan or me. Okay.
But meaning, they're going to have three sons. But within those three sons, the genetics are going to be able to produce all what we call the races. The sons of Japheth are basically going to extend from India through Asia Minor up into Europe and will eventually hit the seas. These are the sea people, will hit the seas and fill the earth. Japheth was promised in his prophecy by that his territory will be enlarged. The territory of Japheth will be enlarged. And we can see this taking place right here. Shem is going to, now watch this, on that map, if you're looking at that map, it's titled The People of Japheth. Japheth is on the top half of that map, moving north and west. Shem is going to start there on the plains of Shinar, and he is going to fill that area and move east, generally. Ham is going to be in the plains of Shinar and move south. Now, it's interesting, Japheth also is going to be in the plains of Shinar and move north. And so if you draw a square right around the area of the Tigris-Euphrates with the Middle East, that is where you've got an overlap of Shem, Ham, and Japheth still remaining at this time, with Shem moving east, Japheth moving north, and Ham moving south. So the further they move away from each other, the more similar their cultures are going to be. But as they move back towards the Middle East, that would be the hotbed of the cultures of Japheth, Ham, and Shem all coming together. Interesting, it's still the hot spot today. Interesting, that's where end of history, if you read Revelation, that is where history is going to end. That is where the millennium, Jesus Christ, is going to rule and reign from. It's interesting, it's right there. And you can say, well, the Bible's just a legend. Well, yeah, but what about your paper today? Except for the global warming article, it's pretty accurate. That was a cheap shot at global warming. If you read it, you'll realize you better get out of Iowa because it's good. It's going to just be overrun with all kinds of problems here in the next couple of years. Okay. I'm going to read through these names right here very quickly. You can watch your map, and I'm going to just read through the list. First one mentioned, the first son of Japheth is Gomer, and you can see on the map where Gomer's at. He's up in Asia Minor or Anatolia. Mentioned in Ezekiel 38, we're going to end up there today looking at Ezekiel 38 and 39. They're mentioned in other places in history they're mentioned. It's not just in this account that they're mentioned. Different historians throughout ancient history record and talk about these people. They'd be Greek historians, Jewish historians, Egyptian priests writing about these people. They originally occupied the area just north of the Black Sea. So you can see Gomer was north of the Black Sea also, moving up into what would be called Russia. And later they would invade the Scythians and move into the Caucasus Mountains, which would be more over towards the Caspian Sea in that area. So Gomer's going to be there. Don't forget Gomer. It's coming back again later. Gomer's not done in history. These people, their descendants, of course, still exist today. Magog, again, mentioned in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Magog is always against Israel whenever you see it in Scripture. And Magog is located in the area between the Black Sea and Caspian Sea and extended up into the steppes of Russia, moving up into Russia. Magog is the Russian people. That is the Russian area that they went into. Keep that in mind. Is Russia still a player in the world history today? Yes. Are these people still there? Yes. The Bible's not done talking about the people of Magog. Medea. These are the Medes of the Old Testament. You can see them right there in what we'd call Iran, probably more like Iran right now today. But they are the Persians. In fact, the Iranians that used to be called Persia even in recent history, and recently just changed their name in recent history to avoid the stigma of the Persians. But they are still the Persians. And that is, you can see Mede right there. And that they would have extended over into India. It goes on, they opposed the Assyrians. They fought against the Assyrians in 800s. They joined the Persians around 580 B.C. Remember Daniel's prophecy of the statue? The two countries come together, the Medes and the Persians, Cyrus and Darius. They united and destroyed Babylon, took over Babylon, and ruled until Alexander the Great came of the Greeks. And they occupied modern northwestern Iran. Number four, another son of Japheth was named Javan, associated with the Greek tribal named Ionia, who lived on the western coast of Asia Minor. So now if you find Asia Minor, which is right where Gomer and Anatolia is, Javan is on that coast right by the Aegean Sea. That is where they settle, and of course, they are then going to cross the Aegean Sea and settle Greece. So Javan is Ionia. It's the same group of people. They become the Greeks. And again, will continue to move west and north. They're mentioned in Ezekiel 27 as being traitors with the Phoenicians, and we'll talk about them. Now remember, there's going to be certain names of people we're going to be mentioning that come from Shem or Ham that we're not going to see on the map today. They're going to be different places, but they're going to be trading with these descendants of Japheth. Javan is also mentioned in Isaiah 66 and Ezekiel 27 in prophecy. Tubal, it's a territory in eastern Anatolia or in eastern Turkey, and you can see Tubal right there by the Caspian Sea. In that general area. They were called, and all these names, they go through changes as they go through history, but you can trace the name and the change of the name into other writings, even into writings on, you know, since this side of the time of Christ. Meshech is a territory also in eastern Anatolia or eastern Turkey, along with Tubal. It's associated with the words Musky or Musku in the Assyrian text. So the Assyrians call Meshech Musku. And so it's again, similar. You can see the name there as it's being handed down. Taurus, the ancient Egyptian text called them Tarasha, or however you'd pronounce it. These are later called Etruscans of Italy, and some have connected them with Thrace. And so these are going to settle in. These may be the founders or the beginning of the Romans at this time, of course, several thousand years before they emerged from Italy. That's where they are going to settle. Ashkenaz lived on the northern Euphrates River in Armenia. Again, all these are a fairly similar area. The name of these people are called on in Jeremiah 51 to go along with the people of Ararat, which is right there where the ark ended and where these people settled, and to rebel against the Babylonians. It says, fight against the Babylonians. The Greek historian Herodotus knows them and calls them as the Scythians, which are now, the word Scythians comes up in history, and you're very familiar with that as you read through history. They occupied areas north and east of the Black Sea and into the steppes of Russia. This next one, number 9, every commentary that's being honest doesn't know what they are. Riphath, we've lost contact with them. We don't know what happened to them. Most likely, of course, if you're just going to take your finger and point at the map, you're going to put them in the Asia Minor, southern Russia area, something like this, but we don't know for sure. Togarmah, Ezekiel 27, they're exporting horses to Tyre. Ezekiel 38, they join with God's Magog's invasion. Excuse me, that's another typo right there. Join in with Gog of Magog's invasion. That happened in my book. Type Gog. Spell check changes it to God for you. So that's not supposed to be joined with Gog of Magog. We're going to be looking at those verses here in just a moment. The next one, Elisha. In the cuneiform, meaning that would be the writings of the Assyrians or the people of Babylon, the Chaldeans. The name is written right there, Alashia, and refers to the island of Cyprus. That's a typo too. And if you look at, so you can see Cyprus right there. That is very clearly in most commentaries, that is what they're referring to. The island of Cyprus is where those people settled, which are going to become a trading center. These are going to be called the maritime people, the people that hit the seas and begin moving west, and you can see that there. The next one we're going to mention is Tarshish, and you've heard of Tarshish before. The word Tarshish is related to the word that means to smelt or to burn, to heat up. It refers to metal, forming metals. And so wherever Tarshish is at, there's some kind of a smelting furnace or some kind of production of metal going on there, most likely. And what we're going to see in, for example, Ezekiel 27. If we looked at chapter 20, let's just go to Ezekiel 27. Get your Bibles open up to Ezekiel 27. Here's a classic verse of Ezekiel just going through and talking about world events in his day. And you can see as we go through this, all the different names of the countries. I've actually, in my Bible, I've circled the names of all the countries. So you can just see it's just one country after another being circled here. But as Ezekiel begins to talk to the city of Tyre, which is a Phoenician city on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, just north of Israel, Tyre was the seaport. It was actually an island originally. It was an island that had seafaring people that would continually move out into the Mediterranean Sea. Because in Phoenicia, there on the coast, you can see on your maps where Phoenicia is at. Is it written on there? Well, you can see where Tyre's at. I got a little dot there on the Mediterranean coast there. Just to the east of Tyre is a huge mountain range. And so for them to go and travel east would include going over the mountains and facing all kinds of other nations or peoples. Whereas if they stayed on their own side of the mountains and just hit the seas, the world was theirs. And Tyre's going to become fabulous sailors, and that resulted in fabulous trade and commerce. In fact, if you don't mind me saying, and this is, we could go through and get you evidence on this, but the people of Tyre or the Phoenicians, their writing and their artifacts have been found in Northern America. Did you hear what I just said? In other words, they sailed across the Mediterranean Sea, they sailed out through Gibraltar into the Atlantic Ocean, and just kept going. And when they got to North America, and why didn't they keep coming? Because there wasn't anybody there, per se, that could actually trade anything of value that they wanted. And there is a little bit of thing indication they were doing some kind of trade, but they're there and gone. They tended to go to places like Tarshish, the Phoenicians. And in chapter 27 of Ezekiel, we can read down through the first 11 verses if you want to. You can read about the Persians and Lydia and Put. We'll talk about more about them in coming weeks. We'll talk about Ham. But in verse 12, Tarshish did business with you, speaking to the people of Tyre, the Phoenicians, because of your great wealth of goods. They exchanged silver, iron, tin, and lead for your merchandise. In other words, when they got to Tarshish, they had metal goods that the people of Tyre could trade. Of course, the people of Tyre were basically a merchant people. They were just collecting stuff from people and exchanging it on the open seas. And Tarshish now comes down to this question, if you don't mind, is where is Tarshish? It always refers to some place that you've got to get into a boat and go to. And you have to take they're sometimes called the ships of Tarshish. And when it mentions in the scriptures the ships of Tarshish, it's talking about large ships. Ships that are seaworthy of going through the Mediterranean Sea and even into the Atlantic Ocean and returning. So the ships of Tarshish weren't like little canoes or little boats or little, you know, barges just going up from Egypt and back and forth carrying logs. These were incredible ships. You know the story of Jonah. Well, I could flip there and read part of it, but you know the story. Jonah goes down to the city of Joppa when God calls him to go to the Assyrians. He doesn't want to go preach. He wants to go, supposed to go to Nineveh. He goes instead down to Joppa, gets on a ship, and says, take me to Tarshish, which is in a sense of saying, take me as far away from this place as you can get me. Tarshish, I believe, I've got it labeled as Spain, which is not that's a fairly common place, but it means the far extents of the Western world. Take me to Tarshish. And he's on his way through the Mediterranean Sea to get out of Israel so he can disobey and not have to fulfill his calling. So we know that Jonah could get in the Mediterranean Sea in Joppa and sail west and reach Tarshish. The problem comes, if you're interested, and I'm trying to get you interested, if you'll go to 1 Kings chapter 10. Okay, hang on. I'm trying to. It's a genealogy, talking about nations. Should talk about global warming or something. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 22. Two kings of Israel, or Judah, Solomon and Jehoshaphat, both realized the need for trade on the sea. Many of the kings of Israel were just happy just to live in their own little area and defend their country and do some caravan trading. But both Solomon and Jehoshaphat says, you know what? We've got to hit the seas. We've got to compete with Tyre. We've got to compete with the Phoenicians and get some of this trade from Tarshish. Well, Solomon is looking for gold. And if you look in chapter 10 of 1 Kings, verse 22, the king, chapter 10, verse 22, the king, that Solomon, had a fleet of trading ships. Now, if you look down there, please, I'm not sure what your Bible says, but in the NIV, it's got a little Q by the word trading ships. And what does it say down there? The Hebrew word is not trading ships. The Hebrew word is what? Ships of Tarshish. In other words, these are seaworthy ships. So it says, the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea, along with the ships of Hiram. Hiram was the king of Tyre, the king of Phoenicia. So Solomon says, hey, I want in on the action. I want my own ships for Tarshish. Once every 3 years, it returned carrying gold, silver, ivory, and apes and baboons. So wherever these ships went, it took a year and a half to get there a month to load and unload, and a year and a half to get back. I mean, you might as well be going to Mars. And they were. In their mind, it's like, we're going to Tarshish. We'll see you in 3 years. And they'd load up the ship, and they'd come back. And when you can imagine the day they sailed back in from Tarshish. These are the sons of Japheth that have gone off into Tarshish. They got smelting furnaces. They've got all these things. And when they come back, we've never seen these things before. Trading ships from Hiram. Once every 3 years, they came back. Now, if we read on and we put this in context, the issue with this is, do you know where Solomon was sailing from? Turn over to your map again. He was not sailing, and neither was Jehoshaphat. We could look at this more. I got more verses, but I'll spare you the other verses. Is you see down there the Red Sea, you know, the Red Sea, Sinai Peninsula, Moses crossed the Red Sea. You know where we're at on the map? There's a place called Ezion Geber. It's a seaport in the Red Sea. That is where Jehoshaphat and Solomon sailed from. That was their seaport. So now they are reaching Tarshish, wherever it's at, by getting in the Red Sea, sailing south into the Indian Ocean. Now, Solomon did sail through the Red Sea and go down and get the gold from Ophir and different places, some of the African countries on the eastern coast of Africa. But he's going to Tarshish, and it doesn't take a year and a half to go to the east coast of Africa and back. I mean, they could walk there. So apparently, or at least it's something to consider, if Tarshish is Spain, Solomon and Jehoshaphat were going down the Red Sea into the Indian Ocean, down around the bottom of Africa, up into the Atlantic Ocean to Spain. And it took 3 years to do it. Nonetheless, I'm just presenting that. It's not like, well, is that a Bible doctrine? That's just an indication of that. These people wanted to get to Tarshish. Jonah went there through the Mediterranean Sea. Solomon and Jehoshaphat went there through the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. So wherever Tarshish is at, you can get to it two different ways. One going to the west and one going to the south. It puts it a long ways away from the land of Israel. But nonetheless, that's the land of Tarshish. Okay. There's more things we could read about Tarshish, a very important city. Also, number 13 that's on the list is the city of Kittim. It is also a Phoenician city on the possibly on the coast of Cyprus, the island. But it refers to anything in the west also. So the people of Kittim continued to move west. And then you've also got the next one there, Rodinim, which is the island of Rhodes, which is right off the coast of Asia Minor to the southwest. And also, I want you to notice, go back to that little chart, please. The chart on page 1 of the line of Japheth. And what we've done is the three sons coming from Gomer are the sons that moved up into southern Russia. And we're going to that verse right now to talk about a prophecy about those groups of people. These are the people that moved to the north into the steppes of Russia, the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, the Caucasus Mountains. But Javan, the fourth son of Japheth, if you look at his four sons, Elisha, Tarshish, the Kittim, who settled in Cyprus and kept moving, and Rodanim, these are the people of the Mediterranean world that moved west. And if you consider the fact that Javan is another name for the Greeks, Javan moved to the land of the Greeks, and from the land of the Greeks, Javan's sons went even further west. So it makes sense. Javan moved to Greece, and then Tarshish moved to Spain, and they just kept moving into the west and going up the coast, probably going all the way up into Europe along the coast. Nonetheless, that is a little bit about Japheth and the people that came here. Their territory expanded. They were traders. They moved up into Russia, filled Europe. But they also remained in the general area of Shinar because that's where they originated from. They're going to mix it up with Ham and Shem to some extent, but not as much as Shem and Ham are going to live together. Now, very quickly as we, oh man, I got so many things we could look at here. But go to Ezekiel. Ezekiel 38, again, here's a set of verses that you're probably somewhat familiar with. But now when we read these verses, and you may say, why are we doing this? Why? This is boring. It's Mother's Day. Well, all these sons had mothers. Happy Mother's Day. Okay. But it's like, what is this? Why is this important? Well, I mean, this is important in the sense that if we're going to read Ezekiel 38 and 39, there's a bunch of names of peoples there that are doing things. It's like, we don't even know who these people have even heard of these people. Well, the writer of Ezekiel, did know of them. And he knew who they were. And the reason people today can read Ezekiel 38 and 39 and go, I have no idea what's that being talked about, is because they have no background. Why do you think we've got two chapters, chapter 10 and 11? I know, man, it's genealogy, Tower of Babel. We knew the Tower of Babel in Sunday school. Why do we got to cover this again? This is ridiculous. Well, there's two chapters on this, of where these people are. It's foundation. If you're going to understand prophecy, if maybe you don't care about prophecy, but if you're going to understand prophecy, if you're going to understand world events, if you're going to understand the context of the scriptures, you've got to have at least some introduction. At least I've given you an introduction. You can say, well, I want to know more about this. You can at least know where to go look for answers or ask some questions. But nonetheless, here's a classic example of why this needs to be covered at least in some kind of level. Chapter 38, verse 1. This is now God speaking to Ezekiel. And it's going to say in these verses, in the last days. In the last days, this is what's going to take place. He's not saying this is what has taken place previously. So this is not historical information. This is not information about the coming events in Ezekiel's lifetime, like the Babylonian captivity or them being sent back to the land. No, those things are all covered in Ezekiel. They're already detailed in Ezekiel. Ezekiel begins by saying the captivity is coming. And while he was saying it, it came, and the captives came walking into Babylon. He says, I told you it was coming. Then he began to tell them what's going to happen, including Jeremiah. He says, you're going to be here 70 years, and then you're all going back. So that was their immediate future of the next generation. That's covered in Ezekiel. But then Ezekiel goes and he says, after saying, you're going into captivity, which just happened, which made him a true prophet. He says, you're going to be taken captive. Look, you're here. I'm a true prophet. And then he talked about what's going to happen in the next generation. He then projects out even further and says, in the final days. And when I say this right here, this has not happened yet. Because one reason, these nations we're about to mention have never come together to execute this. There's been many battles. Israel's got problems. They've got the invasions. They've got suicide bombers. They had the Nazi concentration. There's several things that have happened. But this event has not happened, nor in ancient past, nor since Ezekiel wrote it. So he says this. In other words, what I'm saying is these events are yet to take place. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, set your face against Gog. That's the name of a man, a king, a prince, a leader, of the land of Magog. Is that like the land of Nod or the land of Narnia? It's just a fictional place somewhere? Well, yeah, if you're just reading this for the first time and you're scripturally illiterate, the land of Magog is like, who knows what that means? I feel that God is saying, Magog, you can do that if you want to, but you know what Magog is. Look at the map. Where's Magog? Magog, they settled between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and they moved into the steppes of Russia. This is the northern land of Russia. It's not Tarshish. Tarshish is to the west, and you got to use boats to get there. Magog is the land directly north of Israel up into Russia. It's like, you can't even, it's like, once you get there, there's no longer any imagination needed. You don't need to guess or speculate. He says, Gog of the land of Magog. There's a man by the name of Gog coming from Magog sometime in the future. Now, if his name is going to be Mr. Gog, Bill Gog, you know, Bob Gog. I mean, it's like, I don't know. But somehow Gog is going to be a reference to his name. Obviously, we'd want to be concerned of any Russian leader who runs for president named Mr. Gog. Okay? I don't know if it's going to be that easy. Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. What, are those like animals or something? No, Meshech and Tubal are, as we look back here on your first page, Meshech and Tubal are sons of Japheth, as Magog is. So here's three sons of Japheth being mentioned in one verse. And says, you are the chief prince, meaning now these two sons, Meshech and Tubal, have united under the leadership of a third son of Japheth. And where'd Meshech and Tubal settle? Well, let's look on our map. Oh, they settled right by Magog in the Caspian Sea area. So it's like, so far, we're not stretching anybody's imagination. Prophesy against them and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Gog. That's not good. Chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. He says, I am against you. Whatever you have done. Now listen, was Japheth cursed? Japheth was blessed. He says, your territory is going to be expanded. So the reason God is against Magog, Tubal, and Meshech is something that has happened in their, in a sense, probably their recent history. Because Japheth was blessed. He's going to dwell in the tents of Shem. Live happily ever after, boys. But as history unwinds, this group Magog, Meshach, and Tubal are going to have done something where God is going to say to their leaders someday in the distant future, in Ezekiel's day, I have come against you. And this is what the Sovereign Lord says, I'm against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I will turn you around. You're going one way, but I'm going to change your mind. I'm going to put hooks in your jaws, meaning I'm going to force you to do something, and bring you out with your whole army. I'm going to put hooks in the mouth of Gog, turn him around, and when I start pulling him, his whole army is going to follow him where I want him to go. Your horses, your horsemen, fully armed, and your great horde with large and small shields, all of them brandishing their swords, all of their weapons. You're going to bring your entire military right where I'm pulling you. Oh, look, verse 5. Persia, Cush, and Put will be with them. Now, of course, we haven't covered them. We got to cover them next week. But Persia, of course, that could be Media. Okay, so we may have covered them. That would be Iran. I mean, I know it's hard to imagine today Russia and Iran coming together in a battle against Israel. Wait, no. Didn't Iran just say last week that Israel's nothing but a rotting corpse? And they're getting, I think possibly we're getting close to something like this. The chief prince goes on, he says, Persia, Cush, and Put, we'll have to talk about them next week, will be with them, all with shields, helmets, also Gomer. Now, could this be Gomer Pyle? Gomer, where's Gomer at? Gomer would be eastern Turkey with all its troops and Beth Togarma. Now, Togarma is right there by the Caspian Sea, but this has got the word Beth. It's called Beth Togarma. That would be the Armenian area. So they're all in the same area. See, it's that one little area right there. From the far north with all its troops and many nations with you. Now, when it says far north, that would take those people and expend them even in the future further where they've had time to migrate further into the north, which would be, you know, good enough for today. Get ready, be prepared, you and all your hordes gathered about you, and take command of them. So Gog is going to lead this group of countries, this coalition of forces. After many days, that would be in the future, you will be called to arms. In future years, you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. My friends, if we just allow ourselves to read that, he says, you're going to be called to attack a people, attack a land that has recovered from war. Now, Israel would be a land that has recovered from war, if you consider the war of 66 to 70 AD, or if you want to consider the wars of the Crusades, if you want to consider the wars of the Muslims that came before the Crusades, you want to consider the war of 48, war of 67, war of 73, the war of what's going to take place next week. I mean, it's going to be a land that has recovered from some kind of war, whose people are gathered from many nations to the mountains of the Lord. Well, that is indeed Israel. It's not a people that have lived there for all these years. They've been scattered. They're scattered by the Assyrians, by the Babylonians, by the Romans finally. And someday it says that they're going to be regathered and they've been scattered to the nations. From all nations, the people are going to come back to the land that has recovered from war, which had long been desolate. They had been brought out from the nations and now all of them live in safety. Now, some would say, well, that can't be today because Israel is a very dangerous place to go. Indeed, there is a truth to that. Except I spent 3 weeks in Jerusalem this summer. And as I was walking around Jerusalem, unarmed, kids would ride by on their trikes, unsupervised by their parents, who were off talking somewhere by a shop. I mean, indeed, they are surrounded. If you look at a map of Israel and you see the countries that surround it that are calling for their extermination, you could fit three Israels, I believe, no, maybe four Israels into Iowa. It's like a little sliver of land surrounded by countries that are calling for its extinction. It would be like living in southwestern Iowa, the southwestern corner, and having the rest of the United States having nuclear, not nuclear weapons, because they don't all have nuclear weapons, but having any kind of weapons, including suicide bombers, trying to get in and annihilate southwestern Iowa. How long would southwestern Iowa last if the rest of the United States decided we cannot have these people live here any longer? I mean, like by 6 o'clock tonight, it'd be over. I mean, imagine having that kind of pressure around you. I mean, completely surrounded. And yet, when I went there this summer, we flew in. We went through the little check, made sure I didn't have a bomb. Had to walk in. And I walked in and started walking around, getting on bus, going from place to place, kids riding tricycles, buying ice cream. I'd be drinking Coke. It was like I'd sleep at night. And the only thing that would wake me up in the middle of the night would be the Muslim call to prayer. It's like, now again, I'm not saying that's fulfillment of that verse. There may be something greater coming. But Israel is, in a sense, recovered from war. People have come back, and it's voting for government officials. It's got newspapers operating, businesses going on as usual. Well, you and all your troops and the many nations with you will go up, advancing like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land. I mean, a lot of people coming down from. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. On that day, thoughts will come into your mind. You'll say, you'll devise an evil scheme. You'll say, I'll invade a land of unwalled villages. Now, the only walls in Israel today are the old walls of Jerusalem, which you just drive right in, or the walls, the partition walls they put up around the Palestinian cities to keep the suicide bombers from walking across the street and blowing up their restaurants. So there's walled cities, but they've walled in the Palestinians who are trying to kill them all. So possibly unwalled villages even today. I will attack a peaceful, okay, and unsuspecting people. Now, I have to admit the word unsuspecting people doesn't describe Israel today because everybody's carrying a weapon because we are suspecting an invasion any time. All of them living without walls and without gates and bars. I will plunder and loot. This is what Gog says. I will plunder and loot and turn my hand against the resettled ruins and the people gathered from the nations. That's where the Jews came from now. Rich in livestock and goods, living in the center of the land. That's what I just described to you. In the center of all these nations is one land, Israel. Sheba, which you don't know where that's at yet. That's Yemen in that area. Dedan, which is southern Edom. And the merchants of Tarshish. Now you know where Tarshish is at. It's at least Spain, but it's the countries of the West. And her villages. Villages are the lands settled by Tarshish. Which is interesting. Didn't Columbus come from Spain and sail the sea? And I mean, all the villages that came from Tarshish will say to you, have you come to plunder? There's a group of nations which would include the area like Saudi Arabia, Yemen, southern part down there, extending over into the western coast of Tarshish and moving west, some of the western European states saying, wait a minute, Gog, this is not a preemptive war. This is not self-defense. You're on the move only to plunder Israel. There's no threat here. So there's going to be some are saying, wait, don't do this. But again, it's interesting to point as we go through this. Tarshish and Sheba and Dedan don't do anything about it. They just say, I don't think this is right. Instead of actually being able to act. In other words, they're at a place where Tarshish can't even function in the world scene here, going, I don't think you should do this. This is just for plunder. But they don't do anything about it. Have you gathered your hordes to loot, to carry off, take away livestock, goods, and to seize much plunder? Therefore, son of man, God now speaking to Ezekiel, prophesy and say to Gog, who is now the chief prince of Magog and Tubal and Meshech, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In that day when my people Israel are living in safety, will you not take notice of it? You will come from your place in the far north, you and many nations with you, all of them riding on horses and a great horde, a mighty army. You will advance against my people Israel like a cloud that covers the land in the days to come. O Gog, I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. In other words, there's a day coming that God, whenever, again, it's a different time periods in the future we could put this in, but the northern lands of Magog, which would include Russia, siding with today Iran, is going to come in like a horde to plunder Israel. Some other nations are going to say, you're just doing this for plunder. This is not preemptive. This is for plunder. And God says, let it go, because I am going to show you that I will defend Israel. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Are you not the one I spoke of in former days by my servants, the prophets of Israel? At that time, they prophesied for years that I would bring you against them. This is what will happen in that day. When Gog attacks the land of Israel, he says right there, I said this in the prophets. The prophets knew this was coming. Now it's going to happen. This is what will happen. When Gog attacks the land of Israel, my hot anger will be aroused, declares the sovereign Lord. In my zeal and fiery wrath, I declare that at that time there shall be a great earthquake. So God's going to start with earthquakes in the land of Israel. The fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the beasts of the field, every creature that moves along the ground, and all the people of the face of the earth will tremble. In other words, the earthquakes that strike Israel, it says, all the peoples of the earth will tremble. In other words, not just because you read about it in the newspaper, but because, uh-oh, what was that? The earthquake in Israel that is overthrowing Gog's invasion will be felt throughout the earth with some kind of effect of saying, something's going on. Now laugh at me when I say in Peleg's day, the earth was divided and the continental plates shifted. Well, that's impossible. How about this, an earthquake in Israel that in Iowa they go, what's going on? Something's happening in Israel. He says the whole world will know that I am involved in this. It says, the mountains will be overturned. That means the continental plates will shift so much that some mountains will change. They will collapse. They'll fall. Something will happen. The cliffs will crumble. That's not hard to imagine. And every wall will fall to the ground. I will summon a sword against Gog on my mountains, declared the sovereign Lord. Every man's sword will be against his brother. In other words, it's the old-fashioned type of problem there. When you've got two nations fighting, that they'll turn and fight against each other instead of fighting the right army. I'll execute judgment upon him with plague and bloodshed. I will pour torrents of rain, burning sulfur on him. Now, if there's earthquakes, that could release volcanoes, which will shoot stuff up into the air, which will affect the atmosphere. And now you've got storms, you've got rain, you've got fire falling out of the sky. And so I will show my greatness and my holiness and will make myself known in the sight of many nations. In other words, all the nations are watching this. Then they will know that I am the Lord. And it reads on, talks more about this, but basically what takes place, we've got another whole chapter defining that, and we got to quit. But what's going to take place, Gog and his forces and the coalition that came with him are going to be wiped out in the mountains of Israel. Israel's going to be delivered, and the world is going to see this wasn't America defending, even Israel defending itself. This was nature or nature's God wiping out the forces of the north that came against Israel. It's going to take them months, 7 months to clean up the dead. And it's going to lead into some kind of a phase right there. Now we get into eschatology. When is this going to take place? But that is the day that's coming. The sons of Japheth are involved in this in two forms. Some of them in the west and the south, well, the west sons of Japheth, are saying, wait a minute, this isn't right. The sons of Japheth in the north are coming down and say, we want this plunder in this land. It used to be a desert. It had been abandoned. It was a wasteland until Israel was brought back. They began to produce so much so that foreign nations want the plunder from that land, the crops, the cattle, possibly the oil that's yet to be discovered in the land of Israel. That makes it a very valuable place. I'll say that one more time. The oil in the land of Israel. All the areas in the Middle East, there's one land that has never tapped into oil. One of the great rabbis says, why did God give us this promised land? It's the only land in the Middle East that we don't have oil. Well, at this point, it's hard to imagine there's not oil in Israel. And if oil is found in Israel, what are the powers of the north going to say? We want your crops, we want your cattle, but we really want those oil reserves. Well, anyway, we'll see what happens. It's interesting. Father, we do thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the truth of your scriptures. We do ask that we'd apply them correctly to our lives, that we'd see your hand in history from the beginning of the formation of nations all the way through the controlling of the nations until the ultimate return that you have to this land. Father, we do thank you so much for watching over us and ask you to be with this church. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.